6 minutes past 1 o'clock Central Time. You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jeff Bossert, sitting in for Celeste Quinn. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Our technical director this afternoon is Jason Croft. Listeners, today are welcome to call in for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She's our guest. She usually joins us on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise. We'll also discuss grocery shopping today. And welcome, Susan.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
There have already been calls, apparently, and we will welcome yours at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And why don't we talk a bit about grocery shopping issues we have had? We had this E. coli scare with the spinach.
Right.
And there was a story, I believe, this morning on Morning Edition that said, you know, now shoppers are confused and concerned about, you know, going back to the shelves now that the spinach is shaped, the spinach is supposed to be okay, but, you know, a little bit of a concern there.
Well, I think it brings up a couple points. I think one thing to remember is that it's really important with any food product we buy that's fresh to go ahead and wash it again. And so, you know, we have the idea now, okay, if we get bagged spinach, you really want to wash it, not just in water. Sometimes I'll actually put vegetables or fruits in a little bit of lemon juice and water, and that rinses them a little bit better. But just remember to do that with any bag salad in general. And then, you know, of course, thinking about any fruits and vegetables that you buy. You know, a good example is something like a melon. Not a lot of people don't think of washing the outside of a melon, like a watermelon or cantaloupe or something. But really, you need to wash the outside of that with soap and water pretty well, because if you cut through that and it's got some, you know, bacteria or germs on the outside, which could easily happen, that can get right into the middle of the fruit and then you eat it. So I think it's just a good reminder to make sure that we are being careful with washing our produce and, you know, keeping that in mind when we do eat. I think in terms of food safety and foodborne illness, a lot of these things really happen at home when we're not as careful as we need to be as well. But it's just a really good kind of fresh reminder. And if people are still really concerned, you know, one question I've gotten a lot is about frozen spinach. And frozen spinach is very healthy. Usually it's flash frozen very quickly. And so if you're not comfortable eating certain things, you know, go to that, because you're going to get a lot of the nutritional value as well. So
we already have a call. Line four, someone from Bradley is calling us. Hello.
Yes. Both my husband and I have osteoporosis, and we're taking calcium. And we're adding up the totals. He's taking a combination with calcium with D, so he's getting 1,145 milligrams of calcium, but with his multivitamin, he's getting 1,000 vitamin D. He doesn't want to take more because he's afraid of taking more vitamin D. He's 76.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm taking one that has some magnesium, and I'm getting 1,120 calcium, 900 D, and 260 magnesium. I'd like to take more of that formula.
Mm-hmm.
Be 1,450 calcium, 1,025 vitamin D, and 260. Well, now I mixed up. Of magnesium.
Mm-hmm.
Are any of those levels too high?
Well, here's a good starter place. You know, when we look at calcium intake, generally the upper level, or what we call, part of the dietary reference intake's tolerable upper intake level of calcium for adults is about 2,500 milligrams a day.
Uh-huh.
So that gives you kind of a place to think about. Now those weren't really developed to say get that much necessarily.
Right.
In terms of recommendations, you know, generally somewhere between 1,000 milligrams and 1,500 milligrams a day is what we recommend. Although in a lot of individualized cases, I have patients or I have clients who really do need more than that, depending upon their, their specific needs. Not necessarily more than 2,500 milligrams, but sometimes if they've got osteoporosis or other concerns, you know, it may be that their physician really wants them to get more than just the 1,000 or 1,500, maybe 2,000 milligrams. But somewhere in that window of saying maybe even 1,500 or 2,000, to me, is sort of, it's not at the upper level, but it's certainly getting a little bit more. You know, knowing that calcium is a big mineral, it can interact with some other things too. And So it would be something that you'd want to make sure your doc knows and approves of course, and thinks is fine for you specifically. You know, vitamin D, usually the trend in vitamin D research has really been that most people, particularly in the upper Midwest, are really low in vitamin D or could be potentially low in vitamin D just because we don't get that much from the sun. And so when you look at amounts of vitamin D, you know, getting 1,000 milligrams a day of vitamin D is really no problem. A lot of times people are recommending now more than the 400.
How much more? Because he's afraid to go more than 1,000.
Right. And again, that's really variable. One thing I would certainly recommend talking to your doc about is looking at maybe getting, vitamin D levels checked, because maybe this has already been done with your physician, but in some cases I've had clients who've had osteoporosis and it turns out their vitamin D levels are really low.
Oh.
So they end up needing to supplement that pretty heavily. And sometimes it doesn't have anything to do with it. But the upper level intake for vitamin D is 2,000 IUs. I think I said milligrams before. It's 2,000 IUs a day. That's the upper level. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's considered, again, up to that level is considered generally not a problem. But certainly large doses above that might be a problem if it's something your body doesn't need.
What about the magnesium?
Well, magnesium level 2, it's good. I think it's really good to get magnesium with your calcium supplement to actually have that as part of it. And you'll see that a lot in those supplements too. The upper level for magnesium is 350 milligrams a day from supplements in addition to what you get from food.
Okay.
So the magnesium too, about 350 generally thought of in terms of our recommendations in supplement form.
But it's real important to get that combination.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. We generally see vitamin D with calcium because we know it helps absorption, and generally now you'll see magnesium added to those as well. So I think it's a good idea if you can find a supplement that has a magnesium with it too.
Okay. I think that's all. Thank you.
Okay. I might add a couple other things just along those lines too with the caller's questions. You know, with calcium, we do find that generally it's better absorbed if you take it a couple times a day. In other words, if someone's taking 1,000 milligrams, generally if you take 500 in the morning and 500 at night, that's a better way to take it than all at once. Your body's still going to absorb most of it if you take it all at once, but probably not as much as if you divide it out. And the other thing to keep in mind, too, that a lot of times people will take their calcium supplement with a multivitamin that has iron, and calcium and iron kind of compete for binding in the body. So if you take iron with calcium, then you probably don't absorb as much of either one of those big minerals. And so, again, if you're taking a multivitamin with iron and you're also taking calcium, I'd suggest you have at least a 3 or 4 hour window so that you take one and then maybe 3 or 4 hours later another, or take one in the morning and one at night so you don't have this problem with absorption.
We'll welcome your calls for dietitian Susan Kundrat at 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area or Lying Region 800-222-9455. One of the things we're talking about this afternoon, grocery shopping. I've been handed this handout that you can receive if you send a self-addressed stamped envelope to WIOL, but give that address in a minute. We're going through the food groups, and you brought some props in here to help advise me and listeners, hopefully, about some things to look out for on labels.
Right. You know, I think when we look at when we look at grocery shopping or trying to find the best products that are going to meet your needs, one thing that's become very evident is that Americans in general probably aren't getting enough fiber and probably not getting enough whole grains. So one thing I brought here are just these are basically two packages of dry rigatoni pasta. And you've got the package in your hand that says 100% durum wheat. I've got the package in my hand that says 100% whole wheat. And if we look at the labels here, they're very similar except when you get to the fiber area. And if you can see fiber on yours, the fiber is about 2 grams. And that's a wheat product, but it's not 100% whole wheat. Mine is 100% whole wheat. It looks darker. It's more brown than yours. And the fiber here per serving is 6 grams. And so when we look at our goal of serving, you know, fiber at least 25 to 30 grams a day, you can see we're just choosing some of these whole grain products or 100% whole wheat, 100% whole rye or oat products really bumps up the fiber. Basically, you're getting the natural grain. And if we would put these side by side, it's very difficult to tell the two apart. on the label, except for when you look real closely and it'll say actual ingredients. This one says 100% whole durum wheat, and yours will say 100% wheat, but maybe not whole wheat.
Something that often you may have to go up and ask somebody about when you're perusing the shelves at the grocery store. What's the difference between these two? And not an easy distinction for
right.
the average shopper. We have a call for Susan Kunrat on line one in Urbana. Go ahead.
Okay. I had learned that it was a good idea to substitute some of your shortening with ground flax, say. So if you're making a banana bread or a cookie, something, you could substitute like 3-to-1 parts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this sounded all great, and it was, you know, that flax is so great for you. Well, then I read that it's not a good idea to bake flax because I'm not sure if it's turning rancid or something, how it turned into a dangerous kind of fat by being heated up. Does that make sense to you? Or?
Well, I think I do get a lot of questions about flax. You know, there are a lot of books out on flax and health books on flax, and many of them use baked flax in their products. You know, generally it's the ground flax seeds that you use. Certainly when you heat any type of fat, like flax, the same as olive oil or any type of fat, to a certain degree, then the chemical, you know, it may chemically change a little bit, but what I recommend people do is just use, don't necessarily use the flax oil, but actually use the ground flax
meal.
Right, that's
meal, what I'm using.
Okay, because then you get all the benefits from the additional fiber from flax, the estrogen-like properties, you know, that we think are present in small amounts in flax, not in large amounts, and the other benefits of the, particularly the gummy fiber, though, that you get from flax as well as the fats. I don't personally think there's any problem using it in baking, but certainly that's a good point that it may change a little bit as compared to using it when it's not, you know, it's not cooked or it's not heated, because that may happen with other oils as well or oil-type products. You know, with flax, I think, you know, the best way probably to use it or the easiest way is to mix it in something that's, and a lot of people probably already do this, mix it in something that's already kind of a moist product, let's say like yogurt or oatmeal or cream of wheat or, you know, anything like that, where it's going to kind of soften itself, but it's not really going to heat necessarily because it's not going to be exposed to those high temperatures. So I think you still get benefit out of it. I don't think there's any problem using it in baking
okay.
or in cooking, but it may be a little bit different than what, but you'll get everything else out of that flax too.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking to registered dietitian Susan Kunrat, and we can take your calls at 333-9455 or outside the Champaign-Urbana region, 800-222-9455. She's a regular guest the first Monday of the month. On this nutrition handout, which, by the way, you can receive if you write WILL, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to Afternoon Magazine, WILL 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Some of the things that it points out in here, since we were just looking at the rigatoni, we'll talk to you about grains and wheats and, you know, some of the tips it has on here. Look for whole grain breads and cereals like 100% whole wheat or rye breads, whole wheat pasta. Look for whole grain bagels. We have a you also brought your other prop here. We have a Optimum Power Breakfast. This is Nature's Path cereal. And in addition to your standard nutrition facts, you have some other information on the back that isn't normally, you know, so easily located on a box of cereal.
That's right. I mean, nowadays, you know, there are so many good cereals out that make it really easy to get a good dose of not only whole grain, but extra fiber. And even many of these cereals have extra protein added to them. And this was an example of one. This is a cereal that's got, speaking of the last caller, it has some flaxseed in it as well as whole grain. Basically, the main ingredients here, whole grain, whole wheat bran, wheat meal, organic evaporated cane juice. It's got some soy flour. That's where some of that protein comes from, too. Flaxseed, barley malt extract, and so on, and additional fiber. But if you look at this, it's a great way to kind of see how you don't want to look just at one thing on the label. For example, the calories in this cereal for one cup, it's 190 calories. So if you're just watching calories, you might look at this and say, oh boy, I'm just going to go to puffed rice or something that is really, really low calorie. But then you go down the label and you'll see, well, gosh, it does have 40 grams of carbohydrate. You know, that's probably at least two, maybe three carbohydrate servings if someone's diabetic. So it certainly is a is a pretty high carb cereal, but it has 10 grams of fiber. And what we do know is that, again, we're shooting for maybe 25 or 30 grams of fiber a day. So if you think your cereal alone has 10 grams of fiber, throw on a little bit of fruit, you need to get 12 or 13 grams of fiber in your breakfast. That's almost half of what you need for the day. And then it's got 8 grams of protein, which is about an ounce of protein. When people are looking to curb their appetite, maybe they're on a weight loss plan, having protein with your meals, particularly with breakfast, can be a big help too. And so even though this is higher calories, start looking at this, you say, gosh, it's got quite a number of nutrients that are higher than you typically find in cereal. And so this is what you're going to find is going to be a lot more satisfying. And so, again, looking, I think the couple things we want to look at when we're shopping, looking at the label, is definitely looking at calories per serving, but also looking at what is in those calories. If it's just added fat, that particularly added saturated fat, well, that's probably not the best product. But when you're bumping up things like fiber and extra protein, that's really fantastic because it's a big help when you're choosing products like this. And so the other thing I would suggest people look at is serving size and servings per container. Because in this one, there's a serving in one cup, about 7 servings per container. And I have a lot of people whom I work with who end up saying, gosh, well, I ate the package of something, but wasn't that a serving? Well, in a lot of cases, the package is maybe 4 servings. So that ends up being a lot more calories than you anticipate. So whatever those calories say, that's basically for one serving of that product.
Hmm. We have a few callers waiting. We're going to get to line one. It's calling from Effingham. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a runner or jogger. Try to do marathons every few months or so if I can. And I was interested in a comment made by one professional runner recently where she apparently is not taking any kind of supplement at all, no vitamins, no nothing, getting all her nutrition from just the food she eats every day. I just wondered what you thought of that kind of tactic as far as trying to get the proper nutrients and you know, what do you recommend as far as vitamins, if any?
Okay. Well, if you're training for marathons, you may be able to get everything you need from food because your calorie needs are going to be so high. And certainly what I definitely recommend is you try to get as much from food first as you can. There's no question that when we eat food, we not only get vitamin A and vitamin C and these key nutrients, but we're also getting additional plant phytochemicals that are helpful. We get all these other things that are a benefit to us. And I think this whole idea of food synergy, in other words, how foods actually work together to help our body, that's certainly an important issue. So basing your diet on food is really critical. And I think for some people, they can do that. They can get everything they need pretty much from food. I certainly have no problem with anybody taking a multivitamin, even something that's just 100% multivitamin, multimineral. It certainly won't hurt anybody, and it may add some additional nutrients that you need. And then we really look on a case-by-case basis. Does someone, one of the callers earlier talked about calcium. Well, calcium is a mineral that a lot of people don't get enough of. And so, you know, if that's an issue, then we look to get that in a supplemental form. Or for a lot of women I work with who are athletes, they're not getting enough iron. So we try to, you know, enhance that in food, but also supplemental form.
I know a doctor friend of mine and I were talking about vitamins and things, and he said that a lot of people who do the vitamin thing, at least maybe overdo it, are doing nothing more or not much more than giving themselves kind of an expensive waste product, but they're not actually getting many of these nutrients into their actual system, or at least not a very high percentage.
Well, I think it depends on the product. There's no question there. We now have some pretty good resources to tell which products are better absorbed and have what they say in them. One of them is the website Consumer Lab. It's just www.consumerlab.com, which rates different supplements, and they actually do testing on them to tell, yes, does this absorb? Is this actually absorbable, you know, nutrients? And so that's a real help to me because I can look on some of these sites and see what's been tested and what shows up to be absorbable and those kinds of things. And I don't feel like people have to spend a lot of money on additional supplements. Sometimes I'll have clients who come in and they're taking 15 or 20 different supplements, but they're not eating well because they don't have any money left over for food. And so we try to switch that around and get them eating better, and then maybe there are a few things that they need to supplement. And I think people need to remember, you know, a supplement is just that. It's a supplement to your diet. And so our hope is that you can eat really well to begin with, and then where you're lacking, we add the supplements in to be an additional help. but not necessarily something that you rely on as the main nutrients you're getting in. And I do think, obviously, it's really variable now with you, particularly being, you know, running as much as you're running and training. Your calorie needs are so high that you should have a pretty good chance of getting in what you need, primarily with food, because you have the calories. If someone's on 12 or 1,500 calories, it becomes a lot more difficult to not miss out on key nutrients that they may benefit from in terms of a supplement.
Just one last question, if I may. Do you have any opinion on, I guess for lack of a better description, I'll call them the mega vitamins at some of these specialty stores, as opposed to just the one-a-day vitamin, your generic one-a-day, even, or your brand name one-a-day?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the place to start is a one-a-day type vitamin mineral, because in some of the critical nutrients, you can get a good amount in a one-a-day. There are certain supplements that I know are real helpful to people because they have a lot more of key nutrients. Let's say that maybe they do need more B vitamins for one reason or another, or they're trying to get more calcium and they just can't get that amount in a multivitamin. And so in those cases, we look to add additional amounts. But a good place to start is certainly 100% multivitamin. And I think the one thing is my rule of thumb when I'm working with clients is really, is there a functional need for this additional vitamin or mineral or herb or whatever supplement someone is taking? And oftentimes there is. I mean, if we have solid research and it's something that could potentially help, I think we look at that as an additional benefit. But again, you always want to base what you're getting first in food for sure. And no question that from the studies that we have that basing your diet on primarily plant-based diet and then adding in hopefully lean proteins is kind of the way to go, in my estimation, where we can try to get the benefit from all these whole grains and fruits and vegetables and then also make sure you're getting ample protein and other nutrients.
Also, is there any kind of testing that one can do to find out if he or she is deficient in certain vitamins and or minerals? Is there any kind of general testing that can be done to determine this?
Yeah, I mean, there are tests. Some minerals and vitamins you can test with blood. Some can't really be tested in the blood as well. There are tests like hair analysis and those kinds of things. The problem with some of those is that, you know, some are accurate and some really aren't very accurate. There are other tests that I've got colleagues who are really interested in buying machines that supposedly will test your antioxidant level when you put your finger in a light ray and these kinds of things. And I don't know that I've seen enough research to say that that's actually true. So you have to be careful that you're not really being kind of swindled in some of these cases. But I would certainly encourage people, if they're concerned or they want to know if they're getting the most out, you know, if there's anything that could potentially be low, to talk with your physician first, find out what could be checked. You know, iron is a good example. I work with a lot of runners. I'm working with a lot of runners right now, cross-country season. And there are so many athletes I've worked with who have been low in iron, low in the storage form of iron, which is ferritin. And as soon as that gets low, then generally training really goes down the tubes. It really, really decreases. And so that's a good example of a mineral that can be tested in the blood, particularly the storage form that we're concerned about for athletes. And if that's low, that will affect performance. And so that's something that's easily tested in the blood.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. We've got a caller on line two, calling from Bloomington. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello. Yes, you're on.
I turned on after you started talking about flax, but I had a question about it. I hope it's not repetitive. As I understand, if you eat just the flax seeds, that you can't digest it that well and pass most of it through. Is that true?
Well, if you eat just the plain seeds, it's difficult to get all the benefit from those seeds if they're not ground up, like you say, because they add the fiber, which is great. But as far as being able to get into that soluble fiber and get the most benefit from it and get the oils out of the seeds, it's best to have it ground or to buy the flaxseed whole. I have a little coffee grinder I use. You can grind them yourself in the coffee grinder. You can buy the flax meal and use it that way. And that way, I think you get the full benefit from flax. And I might just say, too, that, you know, generally we say about 1 to 2 tablespoons a day of flax is usually what's recommended from some of the studies that we have. And because flax really can be a pretty significant anti-constipation agent, you probably don't want to necessarily use more than a couple tablespoons a day of flax, or you may find that it might bother your gastrointestinal tract. But it also may really help you keep regular as well, too, particularly if you're using the ground flax.
Okay, what about the difference between using flax oil and ground flax as far as omega-3 fatty acids? Is there a big difference?
Yeah, there's more omega-3 fatty acids if you just use the oil. But ground flax, I don't have the stats right in front of me, but if I remember correctly, 2 tablespoons of ground flax seed is about 3 grams of omega-3 fatty acid, which is pretty significant, which is more than you're going to find in 3 or 4 ounces of fish, for example, of tuna or salmon. And so okay. It's a little bit different configuration of fatty acids, not quite the same as fish fat, but it's still a pretty big amount. And then if you have the oil, I think it's about double that amount if you have 2 tablespoons of the oil. And so the oil is going to be definitely your best source, but then you don't get the fibers and some of the other things that are a benefit that you would if you had the ground flax.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
We'll welcome your calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. We've got a caller on line 3 from Champaign. Go ahead.
Oh, could y'all tell me about the glycemic index? Does it have the values like counting carbs or something?
Okay, sure. I can answer that. Glycemic index is one way that foods are kind of ranked, and you hear that a lot more now. Glycemic index really is going to tell us, depending upon the type of food, how long does it take for that food to, the carbohydrate in that food, to turn to blood sugar. And so, for example, if you have a food where the glycemic index is real high, maybe that's 90 or 100, it's generally, you know, up to 100, 0 to 100, the higher it is, the faster it turns to blood sugar. That's the idea.
Oh, that's very informative.
Yeah, and so if you look at that, then you say, well, eating more high glycemic index foods, will that raise blood sugar more? Is that a problem? You know, there's certainly a lot of research going on in this area where we're saying, well, maybe lower glycemic index foods that tend to be often higher in fiber, taking longer to digest, maybe they have fat and protein in them as well, that lowers the glycemic index, and that may take longer to digest and maybe won't affect blood sugars as fast. I think the one thing to note is that generally when you eat foods in a meal, let's say if you have a high glycemic index carbohydrate that you might be concerned about, like potatoes, but as soon as you eat meat with it, then that lowers the glycemic index because it's the meal that your body's most concerned with, not just the food. And so I'm not too, you know, I don't think glycemic index is something you have to worry about too much as long as you're eating balanced and you're trying to make sure that your meals and snacks are pretty balanced as well, because that all changes the whole way that your body utilizes the blood glucose.
So there's no specific amount of like carbohydrate?
No, if you're looking to watch blood sugars, then you can certainly be aware there are lists available of the glycemic index in a lot of different books that are out now, you know, of different foods. And you can say, well, I'll try to eat more of these maybe lower glycemic index foods if I'm moderating blood sugar. At the same time, what's going to affect your blood sugar more is really the amount of carbohydrate, no matter what it comes from.
All right.
Yeah, so that
thank
might.
Y'all.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Our guest on the Afternoon Magazine, registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. We've been looking through this, and while we had the callers, I've been looking through this Nutrition on the Move, Best Bets from the Food Groups, a handout that you can receive if you want to send a self-addressed stamped envelope to WIOL. We covered grains. We'll talk about milk products. A couple of the tips here. Buy skim and 1% milk, yogurt or cheese or low-fat cottage cheese and cream cheese. And then it has a few suggestions for the best cheeses. I guess a bachelor like myself that doesn't have a great deal of knowledge about this, I'll go to a friend's house and they have skim or 1%. Where does was that founded in? Some of the knowledge about milk and, you know, why someone is so much better for someone else and comparing them.
Yeah. Well, if you look, really the biggest thing with milk is very helpful because, of course, it's a good protein source. If you look at a glass of milk or a cup of milk, that's 8 grams of protein, the same amount as an ounce of meat. And so it's a good protein source, certainly high in calcium, vitamin D, and so on. But the only difference in milks is really the fat. So if you look at whole milk, or I had an athlete the other day said, I only want to drink vitamin D milk. You know, she grew up on that whole milk. A cup of whole milk has about a pat and a half of butter in it, you know, that much fat, basically. So that's the difference. It's got more fat. 2% has about a pat of butter's worth of fat. 1% has about half of that or a little bit less. And then skim has virtually none or very little fat. And so the only difference in the types of milk that you would drink really is just fat. They still all have protein. They all have calcium. They're all good for you in a lot of ways. It's really more the fat content. And so if you're looking to watch fat for cholesterol or just calories or anything like that, it's a big difference. It might be 80 calories for a cup of skim and 150 for a cup of whole milk. So it's almost double just because of that fat. So that's really the big difference. A lot of people say, well, gosh, I really love the taste of whole milk because it just, it's the way I grew up. It's what I like. And so I encourage them to try 2% for a while, or maybe buy skim and whole milk and mix them for a while, or, you know, get used to that so you still have more flavor. And for many people, 1% is really acceptable because it still has a little more fat flavor than skim. And so that's still very little fat, so that certainly would be fine. And those are the other things to look at with cheese. You know, cheese is something that's real easy to eat, a lot of cheese, for most people. Most people I know really like cheese, including myself. So if you look at cheese, the biggest thing is to say portions. And this may sound a little maybe over the edge, but for a lot of people who are watching their fat and calorie intake but still want cheese, one thing I recommend, you buy a block of maybe the low-fat cheddar or some of the low-fat cheeses, and you just put them into, if that's 8 ounces, then you cut 8 slices and you put them into little baggies, and that's a serving. Because then you know that you're going to have a serving when you have that. Maybe you have that with a piece of fruit or something, and that's a really good snack. So cheese itself, I think, is really good for you. We just need to monitor the fat intake with that, too.
We have a caller for Susan on line one on their cell phone. Go ahead.
Oh, I had two questions for you, actually. The first question, I was at a meeting with a nutritionist was speaking, and the nutritionist indicated that it's maybe even better to eat butter rather than margarine because they're finding that some of the ingredients in margarine are as bad or more harmful than butter. And the second question I had dealt with the amount of minerals that are in the soil that the farmers are working with. I talked to the farmer once, and he said, really, the only minerals we get in our food is what he puts on in the spring. I'd like your thoughts on that, please.
Well, let me answer the first question first, the one that you had about margarines and butter and those kinds of things. It is true that some of the margarines that we have out there are really going to be higher in trans fat and very high in saturated fat, and those are the things we really don't want to be eating much of. And so butter definitely is high in saturated fat too, but it's more of a natural saturated fat product. So with all this interest in trans fat and basically saying, well, how is a product changed when it's made? Does it actually change the composition of the fat, and is that good for you? So many stick margarines or the hard margarines are things you probably want to stay away from. Butter itself, I would say, I don't know that it's necessarily better than those margarines because it's high in saturated fat too, but it's something that you probably want to use in small amounts. The good thing about butter for most people, it has really good flavor, and so you don't always need to use as much as you think. And so if you use a little bit in cooking or a little bit on bread, you can get a lot out of it and enjoy the taste, and you don't have to eat a lot of it. Probably the best option for something you're going to use more often are some of these butter-like products or tub margarines that actually have no trans fat and very little saturated fat. A lot of those are more whipped products, aren't nearly as hard, and are going to be a lot better than the margarine that you'd find in the stick. And there are several products out there like that. And even for many people, you know, they do fine with maybe they take butter and they mix it half and half with olive oil, and you sort of whip that together, and that can work too because that cuts down the saturated fat, but it has really good flavor. Keep that in a tub in your refrigerator.
Great. Okay. And what about the minerals?
Yeah, the other option, the other question about the minerals, I mean, this is a controversial issue. There are a lot of people out there saying our food is not as healthy as it used to be and those kinds of things. And certainly through the years, soil changes. I'm not an expert on that, but I know the soil does change some, and we may not have quite the same mineral content as we used to. But what I recommend to people is say, well, that might be a good reason to eat a little bit more of the produce. And so you may not get quite as much or quite the same, but let's make sure that it's really included. You know, our recommendations now are about 2 cups of fruit and 3 cups of veggies a day. We know a lot of people are not getting that in. And so if we sort of just start with the basics of trying to get that in, we'll increase a lot of those key nutrients, including some of those minerals as well.
What about regarding minerals, I've heard people say that sea salt has more trace minerals in it than you know, our sodium chloride.
Mm-hmm. Sea salt is a good option, I think, to use. I think it's healthy, it's good. When people are watching sodium, no matter what they're watching, you know, in terms of what they're eating, you'd still want to be aware that if sodium is a concern for you, if you have high blood pressure, you're monitoring that, then wherever that comes from, you have to be aware of that. But I think that's more of a natural way to get it in, and some more of the natural minerals as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're welcoming your calls for another 10 minutes or so, talking to registered dietitian Susan Kundrat at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We were just talking about fruits and vegetables in this handout, Nutrition on the Move. Talks about some of the tips to do, you know, to keep in mind when shopping. One mentioned here, use the 50% goal, at least 50% fresh produce with additions of dried, canned, and frozen fruit and vegetables. I hadn't thought about any kind of rule that applied to buying produce.
Yeah, I think with produce, a big question I get from people is they say, well, that's great. You know, I buy all this fresh stuff and then I either eat it and it's gone or I find it rotten in the bottom of my refrigerator. And so they're not necessarily eating everything that they need to eat, or they just run out and they don't have it. And so that's where I really recommend to my clients that they certainly eat fresh, and at the same time, they're not afraid to eat frozen or canned or dried produce, because that's a big help. And a lot of those are very healthy sources as well. The one thing people might need to really keep an eye on is if they're watching sodium, that canned products especially can be real high, or if it's a packaged frozen vegetable, then that can be high if it's in a sauce or something like that. And I think that kind of segues, if we have a second, into the question. We had a question before the show, someone had called in and asked about, you know, whether it's certain foods or certain supplements you're taking, can that be a problem with blood thinning? And I think when we think about, like, if you're on Coumadin or blood thinner, one of the questions I get is, you know, I can't really eat more vegetables because they might be green vegetables that affect the blood thinning and those kinds of things. And one thing I'll say to begin with is that generally, you know, what we generally try to do if someone's on a blood thinning medication is that, you know, we try to get their produce pretty stable for what they take in, and then their Coumadin can be monitored, rather than the olden days where we said just don't eat any green vegetables, don't eat anything that could affect it, because usually those can be monitored with your normal diet. So that's one thing that's good to know. The caller earlier also had some questions about, are there other things that affect blood thinning or affect blood clotting that you can eat, and particularly things like herbs? And so, you know, a couple things I think to be aware of. If you're taking particular herbs, and there are some that I'll mention, that they could affect blood thinning. They could affect how well your blood clots and those kinds of things. And that's why we generally say if you're going to have any kind of surgery a week or two before surgery, your physician will say, please go off any supplements that you're taking because it could affect the thinning. But supplements like ginkgo biloba, garlic, there were a few studies that show that even taking in three cloves of garlic a day, which is not that much, in some studies did increase bleeding time. And so that's one herb that definitely is can affect clotting. Fish oil can affect clotting. So if you're taking omega-3 fats or fish oil, usually not in food, but if you take it in a supplement, maybe 4 or 5 grams a day or more could affect clotting. And vitamin E. The upper limit of vitamin E is about 1,000 milligrams a day. And vitamin E is also a blood thinner. And so I'll never forget a client I had one time who was taking garlic and vitamin E and something else. And when I saw her, she was having a lot of bruising on her legs. And she's like, gosh, I don't know what this is from. And as soon as I asked her what she was taking, it was pretty evident it was probably from the combination of supplements. And once she went off those, she was fine. So I think that just to be aware that a lot of these herbs that are out there can be very helpful, but they also might have side effects. So you have to be aware of the consequences as well.
Got a couple of callers. Line 4 in Farmer City. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about using soy. And I'm a vegetarian, and I eat a lot of soy burgers, protein bars, and I usually have soy milk for breakfast. And I'm a little concerned about if they're, you know, I've heard things about that it can actually stimulate, you know, breast cancer, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you clarify what products are safe and what are not? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, as a rule of thumb, what we want to look at is more soy products that are kind of in their natural form. So let's say if you have tofu, tempeh, miso, soybeans themselves, edamame, those types of products, those would probably be the first ones to have, because those are more just natural forms of soy, which we, you know, think are probably the most protective. Those are the things that have been eaten for a long time in Asian diets. You know, we have kind of a recommendation that, and not everybody agrees on this, but that maybe around 25 grams a day of soy protein is probably, maybe you probably wouldn't want to go over that by much, because we know that most, again, typical Asian diets might have one or two, maybe three servings of soy a day, probably not getting up to more than 25 grams a day. And so those would be the two things I'd recommend first. Use mostly products that are natural forms of soy, or more least processed soy, I guess I would say. And then secondly, try not to go over that 25 grams a day, which is still significant. Could be a third of your protein intake. I'm noting here, I brought in was my most recent newsletter from the Center for Science in the Public Interest. It's called Nutrition Action Health Letter. Some of you may get this already, and I know I've talked about this in the past. But the October 2006 issue, and I've yet to read it, talks all about soy. And so that can be found online too. And so you might want to just get on Nutrition Action Health Letter and try to search that. And I think the newest articles are online for a while. And so there's a big article, you know, looking at soy. And so I think when you look at the safety, those are the things you want to keep in mind.
Okay, quickly, we have a caller in Charleston on line one.
Hi, I want to go back to calcium. I take a chew three times a day, a calcium chew, and I have my 14-year-old daughter also taking this, and she started when she was 13 and a half, and I want to make sure that that's safe for her age.
Well, again, I'd say in terms of what she would need, maybe up to 1,500 milligrams a day of calcium in food and supplements. And so you would probably want to look at what she's getting in food as well as what she's getting in the supplement. And probably, again, unless there's any other reason that she'd need more medical reason, 1,500 milligrams is probably the amount total for the day that she would need.
Uh-huh.
And so you can look and see how much is in those chews. I mean, they all vary. Sometimes they're 500, 600 mm-hmm. milligrams per chew. Sometimes they're not as much. And so I would just say, you know, if she's getting milk products, if she's getting other things with calcium, then you might, you know, want to make sure the supplements aren't more than 1,000 milligrams, something like that.
Or not more?
Yeah, depending upon the amount that she's taking in food.
Okay.
And kind of total with everything around 1,500 milligrams would mm-hmm. be a good goal.
And I'm looking at the ingredients on this chew, and it has hydrogenated starch.
Yeah, it may be just to keep it together like that. You know, generally in those chews, there's not much fat. There's not much to worry about, depending upon the kind.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, hydrogenation is just a way that kind of in, you know, product formulation keeps things a little bit more together, or mm-hmm. keeps the product more intact.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Susan Kundrat has been our guest. She's a registered dietitian and owner of Nutrition on the Move, a sports and wellness nutritionist. You'll find Susan on the web at www.eatandmove.com. That's eatandmove.com. She also has an office at Strawberry Fields in Urbana. Susan, it was a pleasure having
yeah,
you in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.